score. There's one rule.
We got a hole in one in the house. Cameron.
Drinks on Cameron.
Drinks on Cameron tonight. There you go. What do you say? 14, right? 14. Love it. You know what the yardage was? 168. Hell yeah.
What club did you? Yeah. What club did you hit?
He hit a driver. Freaking love it. Freaking love it. All right. Well, we're back.
That's awesome. I've only witnessed one.
Well, we topped out there on the audio levels. Well, we're back podcasting at the pub every Wednesday night starting at 7 p.m. So you can come out here to the back porch of Franklin Bridge, get you some food, get you some drinks. We got some chicken tacos tonight that are apparently
They're really good. They're really good.
Love that. So we're back with our second installment of the night, podcasting at the pub, where we get to ask Scott Hasse, the PGA Pro Director of development,
player development.
Goodness gracious.
There you go.
Too caught up on the hole in one here. So we're going to get to ask Scott some questions here in this episode of the podcast. So feel free to come on up and ask a burning question. Ask a burning question to Scott, anything about your game that you need fixing at all. So
come on up.
I guess we'll kick it off. We've any questions?
Come on. Come ask.
We need a question.
Yeah, we got one.
There we go.
Getting it started. This Sumit, is how it starts.
Sumit, I'm looking at you tonight, too. I need a question from you.
Sumit's always good for a question. Make sure the mic's on.
What's going on? Let's make sure the mic's on. Go for it.
Get close to it.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, put your face right up to it.
You can raise it up, too.
Yeah. Pull it up.
Yeah, you won't break it.
There you go. You won't break it at all.
First time podcasting here.
There you go.
Bam. There you go.
So, Scott, what do you consider good practice, and how do you practice?
Ooh, nice. Man, I love this.
So what do you consider practice, and how do you practice?
So to me, practice is anything that's directed at getting you better for what I will call a competition. Now, competition could mean, hey, I play every Saturday, 18 holes. So anything in regards to getting you ready for whatever that is. Now, it might be tournament play. I don't know what that thing is, but it's something that – where your score matters to you. So in terms of how to effectively practice, there's a couple of things that need to be in your practice. One, you need to make sure that you can establish whatever your technique profile is. Like if you're working on, I'm going to use Jack as the example, trying to teach Jack to hit a pull draw as his stock shot, which is weird. Like, you mean you want him to aim right all the time and hit a little pull draw? Yes, I do. And so it's making sure that when he practices, he starts with establishing that technical component. Like, is this correct? Once he can get that going, then I like to do some stuff that we call random practice, which is starting to mix up club and equipment in terms of your full swing. So things like three in a row.
Oh, that's a big Scott Hasse one right
there.
Three
pull draws in a row that land on the right side of the flag. Now, depending on your level of play, you need to designate what those three are. It might just be somebody that maybe is a 15 to 20 handicap, I need to get three balls in a row to draw. I don't care where they land. It needs to be appropriate to your skill set, because if it's too far above your skill set, then you'll never succeed at it. And we're back to the confidence thing we just talked about. You're not going to be able to build genuine confidence because you don't have a correct and appropriate skill parameter that you're going off of. And vice versa, you don't want it to be too easy. Like, if you can knock out three in a row with three different clubs in 3 minutes, then it's probably too easy. Move it to five in a row. Narrow the target. Like, instead of just hitting the green, hit it on the right side of the green. Hitting it in the right front quadrant of the green. Like, you can narrow that however you want. So that would be randomizing the practice. That's harder, but it allows you to sustain the skill. Now, if you struggle with that activity, go back. If you're paying attention, you know what your technical component is that fell apart. So that's kind of the ebb and flow of establish your technique, make sure it's good, then move into some randomized practice, and if you still struggle, come back and reestablish the technique. Because every golf swing has a certain percentage chance of hitting a good shot. Your job is to raise, or my job, and your job is the work that you do, is to raise that percentage. And so you're not going to hit them all perfect, but as long as you're moving the needle forward, we're doing great. Now, that also constitutes going on the golf course to play. So I love two-ball worst ball scramble, two-ball best ball scramble, new out of bounds rule, which I can share with you after. It's one of my favorites. Have I told you about new out of bounds rule?
No.
Oh.
You told me about snake game.
Yeah.
Snake game is fun.
No, new out of bounds rule is basically if you draw a line all the way around the hole, like behind the green and down the sides of the fairway, 10 yards to the right and 10 yards to the left of the fairway is your new out of bounds.
Nice.
So if your ball goes outside of that, you go, like you land to the right of the green on number two out here and it rolls down and goes past that 10-yard mark from the edge of the green, that ball's out of bounds. You got to re-hit one from the fairway. So it's a fantastic. So now that's harder than actually playing, which is a big component to me of practice. Our practice is way too easy. Like, imagine if basketball practice, like, you didn't have to run sprints and you didn't have to run suicide.
It's just like shooting free throws the entire time.
Yeah, like, with no pressure.
Yeah.
Like, you're just out there by yourself. Like, if that's all it was, then that would be an issue. So, make your practice hard. Establish your technique. Randomize it and then go back and establish technique at the end. If you need it. Don't always need it. Does that make sense? No. So, the second part of that question is, what do I do in my practice? So, I start my practice in terms of my full swing. I start with 7 wedges with just my right arm, 7 wedges with just my left arm, and then 7 wedges, everything together, making sure that that basic impact shot is correct. I use a 56-degree wedge, so a more lofted wedge. I don't carry a 60, so I use my 56, but it allows me to I know if I can get my technique in that little area and it's a smaller shot, I can really pay attention to it, and then I build my way up. Like, I have some days, like, I can't get past an 8 or a 9 iron because I can't get the technique where I need it to be, and that's fine. So, like, to me, I don't advance until I can do it the way I need to do it at least a high enough percentage of the time. And then I do randomize it. Like, I'll hit 3 9 irons in a row the way I want before I move to the next club. So I will always put in driver because it's 20% of the game hitting off the tee. So I will always put in driver in a practice session. I start with that wedge and the driver. My goal is I'll skip clubs. I don't hit like all 14 when I practice. I'll hit odds on one day, evens on one day. Or maybe there's a club I'm struggling with. I may hit it more. It ebbs and flows depending on how I'm doing. But, and then putting, oh, man, I like to get on a nice like 6-foot putt that's straight and just – drill that technique straight, stable, over and again. And then I move to some randomized practice with putting, like a 1 foot to 10 foot drill where make it from 1 foot, move to 2 feet, make it from 2 feet, move to 3 feet, full routine, gotta get to 10 feet. If you miss one, you come back down one. So you get to 5 feet, get to 5 feet, come back to 4, if you miss 4, go back to 3, if you make 3, go back to 4, make 4, go back to 5. And I don't leave until I can do that at 3 different locations. Tour players don't spend much time outside of 10 feet. They put a lot of their short putts, hit a couple of long putts for speed, and they're out.
Because like, at that point, like, a tour player is not going to practice double breakers, not going to practice something that, you know, is a massive slider down 15 feet. Like, I feel like at that point, as long as your technique is good, you're gonna be fine with whatever you hit. But one thing that I was gonna say about your practice too is that, like, one thing that I've learned about you just being around you for so long is that, like, and you've said it yourself, you're very confident about it yourself, is that your game 100 yards and in is almost spotless. And that's one thing too that, like, from me going from like an infinite handicapper down to, you know, now probably around what, 7 or 8, you'd say, probably something like that. It's like the shots that are 100 yards and under are just massively important.
Yep.
And so, like, I feel like if you can nail that and really incorporate that into your practice, I feel like you'll at least see the benefits on a bad day if you go out and play.
Right. And you're going to see a lot of that coming in a lot of the programming that's about to get announced here in the next few weeks. You're going to see a lot of that coming for me this year because it's an area everybody struggles with, and they tend to want to ignore it. But I want to do this exercise. I haven't done it recently, but is I hit all the shots inside of 100 yards, and the person I'm playing with hits everything outside of 100 yards. So once it gets inside of 100 yards, it's me, and we'll play the front nine that way, and then we switch roles on the back nine. I hit all the full shots, and then they hit all the short game shots, and they're usually, like, they're banking on, like, oh, your full swing's so much better, and my shot selection's so much better. And
that's a Gary Player thing right there.
Dude, It's absolutely incredible to see what they get to learn by doing that. And I'm not a tour player when it comes to wedge play, but if you put me against most other PGA golf professionals, that's the kind of kingpin.
He said that too. He said it in one of his he was doing some media thing, and he was like, you know, you'll put my short game against you play the long shots, I'll play the short shots. He goes, you will shoot under par. Like, you'll shoot under par. It's just like the way it happens.
Yep.
I mean, like, think about it. If you can,
they're not going to make worse than bogey with somebody like that with a short game.
And like,
make par a lot more than you.
Think about par threes. It's like if you just get it up there and he finishes it off, he's going to get up and down from anywhere on the course too. It's like, I feel like up and downs and these like short shots, 100 yards and in are like pretty much the key to golf.
And everybody can learn that. The other thing is, you see how my practice starts with wedges. Impact is the only thing that the ball knows. So, like, if you can establish good impact conditions with a wedge, it has spillover effects into the entirety of your game from there. But people want to start with their full swing and their iron play. Iron play represents 15% of the shots. Driving in the short game is 85%. You do that, you can fake the rest. Like, shoot, you could just skinny that thing down the fairway and let it roll up near the green, chip it up and putt it, and there's my par, move on. Like, I've hit it wild off the tee, and people are like, man, what'd you shoot? I was like, yeah, one over. You're what? One over? Yeah, that's it. How many greens you hit? Two? Yeah, I only hit two greens. I got up and down almost every time.
It's crazy.
But it allows you to build confidence into the rest of the round. It's like, hey, if my short game's doing great and keeping me in it, all I got to do is hit a couple of good shots with the full swing, and you drop two or three birdies pretty quick. And there you are at two under. Felt like you were going to shoot. Everybody else felt like you shot nine over.
Yeah. No,
so
makes sense.
Does that help?
There you go.
Perfect. Thank you.
Awesome.
All
right. We got another one. Name, phone number, email address, social security number.
Yeah, credit card number, expiration.
All right, Scott, man. You know, I've been to some of your classes, and you had me take my, you know, some of my clubs out, and the driver has been out of my bag now for about 2 years. You know, I've been using my 3-wood, but I want to bring it back. You know, I don't know if it's because of ego or what, but I feel like I'm always coming over the top. I'm always slicing, so I don't have the confidence in it. What can I do to, you know, do I need to play with my driver? If my 3-wood does it for me, play with the 3-wood and keep moving, or what would you suggest?
Ooh, this is a hard question. I'm going to answer this in two different ways. So, first one is, you kind of already know that it's not there. And so, get you in a spot where you can really grind at it. Like, I keep coming over the top. I can't stop coming over the top. I was like, I can get you. Shoot. Because he asked the question, 30 minutes free lesson, hop on Thrive Sports. I give you a 30-minute free lesson. See, this is why you got to come out here. I give stuff away all the time. So, 30-minute free lesson. Come on out. I'm going to get you in a practice setting to the previous question that gets that thing going more on plane or slightly under plane and getting that ball turning over with that draw shape pattern. That'll be one. Two, introduce it on holes that you have confidence it's not going to hurt you on. So that's the first place to enter it. So a lot of times people are like, okay, I'm going to start trying to use my driver, but they use it in a setting like number one probably wouldn't be a good spot to use it. Number two is probably fine. 13 wouldn't be a good spot to use it. 10 would be okay. 11, depending on how far you hit your driver, would. But, like, there's a couple of spots you could introduce it and see if it would be okay. So 17 would be a great spot. 16 would probably be fine because you could aim it far enough and just be okay. Like, okay, let's say you have to remind me, right-handed or left-handed? Right-handed. So, like, on 16 out here, there's water on the right. Reestablish where your new fairway is. All right, the mound's on the left. The cart path is the right edge of my fairway. I'm going to see if I can just knock it straight in the center of that. And if I do that two or three rounds in a row, now I can start nudging my fairway. Maybe the right edge of it is the 150 marker. So that's a hole that you could do that on. And as you build the confidence in it, then you can move it to the center of the fairway and never have to worry about right again. But, like, people will sometimes try to jump in the water with both feet, and in certain settings that's okay. But when you have a club that's so crucial, it's 20% of the game. if you introduce it in a place where you're not confident yet, you're not likely going to perform. Like, there's a reason why the guys that are put in with 3 seconds left on the clock are the guys that are put in with 3 seconds left on the clock. Like, we're not going to take the guy that doesn't have the experience and the confidence level yet to put him there. But I'm going to put him in the game. I'm just going to put him in a setting where he can be successful, build up that success, and then go from there. And so work on it on the range. 30 minutes, grab it on there. You'll see on there on Thrive Sports, go in. It says CTC, 30 minute, $0. Grab that, and we'll set that up and go from there. We got the hole-in-one cheers.
We got shots for the hole-in-one going on behind
that's
us.
That's right. But I think that's the best approach to it is, one, let's get it going in the direction that you want. Two, begin to introduce it. Just don't introduce it in a spot that takes on more risk than you're comfortable taking. Because here's what pressure does. Pressure reveals your most dominant habit. And so if the pressure is high, even if you've worked on the swing, your most dominant habit's likely to come out. So let's remove that as a factor. Number 2 is fine. Number 11 is fine. 16, 17, all great spots to use. It's not really going to hurt you all that much. Probably won't hurt you at all. And so introduce it in certain places that are going to allow you to build some confidence. 6 is a good hole to use it on because you got plenty of room both ways. And so introduce it in a spot that's not going to hurt you too bad, and don't get too worked up if you don't hit it good. Like, you intentionally said, hey, this is a spot I can take some risks to hit this club. So shift the mindset a little bit there, the perspective of it. Hey, I'm going to start trying to build some confidence here, and these are my holes I've said it's okay for me to try it on. Yeah.
I like to hit a draw. So, I was always taught that it's like a railroad track. But, I feel like I'm always off a little bit. So how do I know I'm lining up correctly?
Okay, so I'm actually going to demonstrate this one. If you want to answer this some, I'm going to go grab a club real quick, and I actually want to demonstrate this live, and I'll describe it while I'm doing it.
Yeah, sure.
Does that work?
I'll talk about the first question, too, because, like, in me, so a little bit of background about myself, I started playing golf over quarantine. So I came from playing college baseball. I didn't play at a high level, but I played college baseball. And so for me, when I was learning how to hit my woods, I was super inconsistent, right? Because I was hitting it off the back leg one time, slicing it one time, hooking it one time. And I think what Scott said is really profound, because, like, what I've figured out, and I take pride in my wood game. I really think it's a strength of mine. And for me, I think I do exactly what Scott said, is I'll go out on the range and I'll actually get where we always talk about how it's how you practice, making your practice harder. So when I go out on the range, I'll make sure, if we're going out on the range over here, I'll say, I got to hit this club in between these two poles, right? Mm-hmm. And I'll make my practice super hard. And then, like what Scott's saying, I then introduce it in situations where I can gain confidence off the tee, where I'm like, okay, like, I put that one in play. Like, and now, I used to be deathly afraid of hitting my 3-wood, and now I'd rather hit my 3-wood over my driver, right?
Right.
And so I think it's exactly what he said, really introducing it in situations slowly, and especially making your practice harder to where you then have the experience to then put it out to work on the course. That's really helpful.
Remember,
for me,
confidence is built on genuine success.
So if you're genuine success.
If you put yourself in a situation where you can't have success, or you drastically decrease the opportunity for success, then you're not going to make it. Like, if the jump is too big, then you can't build success that way. Like, if a kid keeps shooting a basket and he's 4 years old at a 10-foot hoop, and he never sees anybody ever make one, he's probably going to be like, I'm never going to be able to be any good at basketball, so he's going to quit. That's why we don't start kids that way. But that's the way we've started kids traditionally in golf, is like, we start them from a full tee box or 200 yards. Like, that's still – sorry, I'm not good at this. New mics, got to get used to this. But, like, if you start them too far back, a kid makes a 10 on a hole. Like, it's no fun making a 10. It's like a kid shooting a basket up there and, like, it only going in because, like, some other tall kid tipped it in. Like, yeah, you can do that some, but it's not going to build any genuine success. So – start there and raise it up. So
okay.
We start the kids at 25 yards, and they get to move back based on their ability to shoot 36 or better from 25 yards. And if they don't do it, then they don't get to advance. Pure and simple. So, all right. So there's a couple common denominators for people that are good at aiming and people that are bad at aiming. I'm sure a lot of people listening to this have heard the Jack Nicklaus, like, intermediate target. Like, pick something a couple of feet out in front of you. I found that in most cases, not all, but in most cases, that's not effective aiming, because that little point there versus how it actually translates out there is a massive difference in terms of your visual perception of things. So every person that I've found that I've done this with in 11 years, I'm sure there's an exception out there, but I'm just going to break demo clubs. So that's why they're demo clubs. But every single good player, I'm going to describe this and then demonstrate it. And then, Jack, you can fill in the middle. So every good player aims the club face first. I see a lot of people aim their feet first and then the club. Or they look and they set the club and then they never look back at the target. And as they settle their feet, everything changes. So if you forget where their target is, your brain can remember where your target is.
Hey, you could even take my setup as an example to this. What I'll do is I'll actually put the club straight. Scott's putting the mic down and starting to demonstrate here. What I'll do is I'll put the club down towards my target. So I'll put the club straight towards my target, like with the toe first. And I will point it at the target, and then I'll rotate around my club and then straighten it out, then take a look to confirm it, and then I'll go ahead and go for it. And that's for me, that's what's made the most sense, and that is my pre-shot routine every time. If you go out and play with me, I do that on every single shot that I have. The only exception is when I'm lining up a putt. That's the only exception.
Right. So the common denominator is they all aim the club face first.
Yep.
So face first, then feet. And as you're getting in to set your feet, so aim the face. Take your time setting the face. Make sure you get the face to where you want. And then look at the face when you set your feet. Don't look at the target. Set your feet parallel to the face. I have yet to find somebody who can't do this. It's super easy to do. Here, Jack will demonstrate it. So, don't do it your old way. Do it. Okay. So, yep. Set the club face. Yep. That'll work. And set the club face. Yeah. So, you're setting the face, but in a different way. So I want you to do it the way that I've asked players to do it. Take your grip first, both hands. You don't have to do it this way, but this is my preference for most people. So both hands first, then set in from the side. Step into the ball there. Yeah, stand all the way to the side of it. Good. Step all the way up to that golf ball, that pink one. So keep your feet close together first, or just step in with one foot. Yep. Aim the face first. And then check that the face is correct. And then as you come back and look at the face, set your feet to the face. You don't even have to set your feet to the target. Set your feet to the face. And you can make those match fairly easily. Then reestablish your look looking back at the target. Then come back to the ball. Remember where the target is and go. A lot of people forget where the target is.
One thing, too, that Tiger says, and he says this specifically in putting, is that he'll, like, when he's putting, he'll set up to the ball, look at the target, and he says, I'll take a picture of where the hole is, and then I'll look back, take another picture, one more picture, and then he remembers that picture in his brain as he's making his stroke.
Right, so this is an easy one. This is an easy example. I'm going to try and do this and not break anything. Come up this way. Stand, like, right here. So, if we're standing here talking to each other, this is really easy.
We got an in-house golf lesson happening.
I know,
right,
this
now
is a lot of fun. So
I love this.
I like to be interactive. So
I love this.
Now, I just got a quick peek at where he is. As long as he hasn't left where that space is, we're good. Now, I can stand here and talk to you for a couple of minutes. As long as he doesn't move, I know where he is. Like, my brain can remember where that is. A lot of times, though, people will forget where they are and where the target is, and they'll go ahead and swing. If your brain loses connection with the target, then you're probably not going to hit a good shot because your brain's not sure where it is and it's going to try and self-correct. So, like, I haven't looked at him. I'm assuming he's still there and hasn't fooled me. I can just toss this over my right shoulder and should get pretty close to him, right? Right. So your brain has the capability of remembering where things are. I had a kid today in junior program. I've told all the parents. I said, do not tell your kid to keep your head still, keep your eye on the ball, any of that stuff, like, doesn't need it. And like one of the kids, I can prove you don't need it. He literally is up there, makes a backswing, looks at me, literally looks me square in the eyes, comes back and just flushes it like 180 yards down the middle. I was like, hey, man, don't look at me. Like, I'm trying to get him out of the habit of looking at somebody. I'm more concerned about he's worried about what everybody thinks. Am I doing it right? Than I am about, like, the fact that he's looking away. Like, his brain remembers where the ball is. It, like, completely doesn't look at it at all and comes back. So your brain can remember where the target is. So even once you've gotten all your setup done, as you're trying to make the best swing you can make, remember where the target is. You can visualize it. Some people feel it. Tiger, I love Tiger's description, like you said, putt to the picture. It's all about putting to the picture. So, like, when I putt, people are like, so how do you know how hard to hit it? Like, do you, like, I was like, I don't know. I just set up. After I've made my practice swings, set up to it, take a look, and then all I try and do is remember where the hole is. Like, I kind of have this visualized position of where that hole is relative to me, and I just make the stroke and trust that my body's going to hit the right distance. I don't know. Like, I've practiced a lot, so that touch is subconscious. But if you don't practice enough as a putter or off the tee, like, your brain's going to have a hard time attaching to that.
I feel like, too, especially in putting, you'll get a lot of players who...
Great questions.
They'll get over their ball, right? They'll get over their ball, and they, like, they won't trust the line that they started with.
It's because they can't start it down the line.
Well, and that's right. But, like, I guess what I'm trying to say here, too, is that, like, I would rather putt... Oh. Yeah, baby.
Nobody can say it like
Chuck. Thank you, Chuck. Thank you, Chuck. So back to what I was saying, like, I would rather trust my line, putt it, and then understand what I did wrong rather than second-guess myself all the way over the ball, make a random stroke that I don't know, miss the putt, and then not know what happened. And I feel like that's what a lot of people do. And if you can just start the your ball on a line that you set, whether this is putting, irons, driving, whatever it is, if you can just trust your thought process up front, you will then learn what that feel is associated with if you can then understand the results and what you did.
Those that have taken lessons from me in the past and in the, like, historically have taken lessons from me, I used to teach that speed is the most important part of putting. And it is, in the sense of, like, you have to be able to match that speed to the line that you've chosen.
And theoretically, there's more room for error.
Yes, that's correct. However, if you can't start the ball down your intended line, you know how much confidence people have if they can't start the ball down their intended line? None. So from a psychological standpoint, I would rather get somebody to start the ball down their intended line a very high percentage of the time, which is why I love the forearm lock putter right now. Like, if it's legal, get yourself a forearm lock putter. Let me fit you to it. Let me show you how to do it. We're actually going to do a whole clinic just on forearm lock putting and why you should try it.
And for those of you who don't know what forearm lock putting is, try looking at Bryson DeChambeau and how he putts. That is a great example of forearm putting. And
he's not the only one doing it either.
Correct.
His is more extreme.
Correct.
But,
but, I mean, what I love about him, too, is that there's little room for him to mess up on that forearm lock putting, right? If you just set the ball out on your desired line, if you read that, and you'll see Bryson, he'll even get down over his ball on, like, a 3-foot putt to make sure that his line is good, right?
Yep.
And what that forearm lock is doing is, like, as long as he sets his ball in the position where he wants, it's going to start out on the line that he's going to take it on.
Because it can't move.
It's, there's less variables for him to worry about.
You can still hit a bad putt with a forearm lock putter, but you drastically take away the concern about starting it online. I'm trying to remember how we got to that, but that's, like...
Well, we were talking about how to set up to a ball, how to really trust your shot, which I think is great. Yeah.
So this is my favorite. People are out there working on their swing, talking about their swing. They're not even listening to me. It's even the best part. And, like, I'm the one who can fix it. And they're, like, this is normal golf. Like, this is what people do all the time.
I love
they're
it.
They're completely oblivious to it, which is the funny part. Like, I could probably answer the question in about 5 minutes in my normal, like, I take forever to answer questions fashion. But
I want
to
ask, hey, Cam, do you have 2 minutes to tell us about your hole-in-one?
Yeah, baby.
We got a big one.
Now, as he's coming up to the mic, this is really important. So, like, being able to recall these moments over and over and over again are crucial to building confidence.
You're on.
You're on, man.
It was a cold and rainy day. No, I almost didn't play. I said, I don't play in the rain. I play a lot of golf. I was glad that I did. It stopped raining. 168 on hole 14, 7-iron. Chuck said it's going towards the hole. It dropped. We freaked out. Ended up headbutting Chuck on accident. Almost lost a tooth. But, yeah, cool experience for sure. Bucket list.
Love it. Yeah. Was that your first one?
Yes.
Nice. First one.
Nice. Yeah.
Hey, round of applause for Cam here. Round of applause for Cam.
Hey, he's showing humility like we talked about in the previous podcast. All right, I know Sumit's good for a question. Chuck's always good for a question or two, too. Chuck's been out for a while with golf. Poor guy.
Hey, Chuck,
thanks
tell me
to
about that.
Accounting. I am not in accounting. That's right. What? That was good for them.
That was good out for the whole group, he said.
He was out. But you didn't get any yeah babies when you
yeah
did
baby.
Awesome.
Yeah. There you go. Wait, so I think this brings up actually a good point and a good question too is, Scott, take me through your thought process on par threes. I think this is a super unique shot that a lot of people have trouble on, right? Because, like, the end is in sight, right? It's like the beginning is here, but the end is, like, right around the corner.
I only have to hit one shot.
Yeah, it's like you only got to hit one shot to get it in, you know? Right. But, like, I feel like that added pressure is, like, something that a lot of people don't understand, right? Or you know, is misinterpreted because, you know, for example, out on hole two days ago, and actually Mr. Rhode Island here was witnessing it too. So I had about like a 170 yard shot on a hole number two to be on into on a par five, right? Mm-hmm. Average par three distance, right? 170 yards,
yep.
Like pretty much a par three distance. My mindset on that shot was, and this is probably to my fault, was drastically different than my shots on the tee box as a par threes. And so what happened on this shot was I was like, okay, pin's back left. I'm just going to, you know, it's back left. So I got my number. I subtracted about 10 yards to let it run up there.
Yep.
Hit a beautiful shot to about like 4 feet on two. And like, but I feel like some people's mentality on those shots is there's a lot more pressure on a par three than there is on just, you know, your average approach shot. So take me through that and how we might be able to be better at par threes.
So, again, pressure is often related to your own perception of reality. So here's the reality for the PGA Tour. Average score on par threes, yes, they're playing from a lot of times north of 180 yards, but not all the time. Yes, they occasionally have a 240-yard par three, but that's not the norm. They're more around that 180 to 190-yard range, which for a lot of them is is around an 8 to 7 iron.
Or you got 17 at the Players, which is like short as hell, but it's surrounded by water.
Right. So the average tour player score on par threes is 2.98.
So literally right at par.
Yeah. So this was Tiger's perspective on playing par threes. If I hit it to the middle of the green and just two putt. Now, occasionally, I'll be able to use the green to get the ball closer to the hole, etc. But I'm going to try and get my ball towards the center of the green and let the green move it whichever way it needs to get closer to the hole. Because if I know if I do that, then the tour average is three. I can smoke everybody everywhere else. I'm not losing hardly. I'm losing 0.02 to the field. Strokes per par three. Like, you know how many par threes you got to play in order to lose a whole shot?
Yeah.
If you just make pars.
Right.
So, like,
there's more opportunity for you to lose a stroke than there is for you to gain a stroke.
Correct. So, like, that's his whole point. So, par threes and par fives, two things. Par threes tend to be more guarded, and par fives tend to be more guarded around the greens as a whole, as a unit. And guarded doesn't always mean, like, hazards or, like, water or bunkers. It can mean slopes. It can mean the green is smaller in certain areas. It could mean the way slopes are built into the green can make it more difficult. It could just be visually the way the hole looks. So all of that can affect par threes and par fives because you can get to them in two.
You'll
tend to be more guarded around the green as well.
You also see a lot of dog legs on fives as well, right? Which is another version of being guarded, right?
Correct.
Which brings up an interesting question too, or an interesting point, because I feel like a lot of amateurs will lose strokes on par threes because they feel like if they make
I got to make a birdie here.
Yeah, like
oh, this is a birdieable hole.
Like you know, just a short hole. I got to make a birdie.
Green.
You know, like I feel like if a lot more people approach par threes and the fact where like I just got to get a par out of this, like just put it close and get up and down, and you're pretty much out of there in with the best of them, right? It's why five here when we're playing tournaments. That's why five here is such a big hole, right? Like if you make it out of there with a birdie, like geez, you stole one, you know? Or you make a par, that's a great par.
The only like real legit birdie hole from the tips out here on par threes is 14,
which is what
which is the hole in one, baby.
Hole in one, baby. There you go.
But like 12, 3, 5, absolutely love those holes. They're beautifully designed, visually challenging, fair but visually challenging. They tend to be fairly long from the back tees, but like they're not super hard by nature. But the way they're built, they can play very difficult. And so for that reason, like, I love those parts. I love all the par threes here. And then you have one, like, easy par three, meaning 14.
You know, that's interesting, too, because, you know, a lot of people who haven't played here before might show up. And this is less so now because of all the hard work that Brooks has put into the course. But a lot of people will come out here, especially before Brooks was here, and was like, oh, this is a, you know, a public course, you know, I don't really like, yeah. You know. They
it's a championship golf course.
It really is.
And it's growing into one.
In its best condition, it really is. And even so now, and that's why I love all the work that Brooks has put into it, because as the course has gotten better and better, you start to see the little architectural details that you might not have been able to see before. And especially like what you were saying on the par threes too, like every single par three out here is pretty damn hard. Except for, I would say the easiest is probably 14.
Yeah.
But, I mean, let's if you go through them.
But it's fair. Like, the green on 5 is big.
Right.
Like,
it's
the
guarded.
Green on 12 is big, except for the top little corner. And visually, but visually, they look really small. And even 3 is large, but it's the way it's shaped makes it play really small.
And here's the thing about 12, too, is that there's not a lot of room for error on the left. And there's honestly not a lot of room for error on the right, too, because you're hitting up to a blind green if you're starting to chip. And you kind of have to hit it right on this shelf from the tips, about, you know, close to 200 yards or 180,
but it's
180,
big.
190.
It's like 80 feet, 90 feet
yeah.
across that thing.
Horizontally, for sure. But, I mean, if you're talking about depth, it's probably, you know, what, 20 feet maybe?
Yeah.
And that's tough. That's tough to hit on, especially that's something that's so elevated and kind of on a shelf. So, I mean, like, We kind of did. We're gonna have to do a whole episode dedicated to the course architecture here at Franklin Bridge.
I keep forgetting we need to do that.
We've talked a little bit about it and how well this course is set up, and how at a blind eye it might not seem so hard, but then when you really start to get into it and play it in championship conditions, it can be a very challenging course.
I need to see, like, superintendents tend to be fairly reserved and don't like giving all their secrets away either. But that might be a good. Maybe we look in sometime late May, early June, Adam and Brooks.
I was going to say get Adam
on the
here.
Podcast.
We
there
could
goes
even,
golf ball.
If we needed to, we could get Logan on here as well.
Yeah, and get them on here and like get a chance to describe, you know, what they're working on the course, but like actually have a dialogue about the design.
Yeah.
And like I get to talk from a teaching standpoint and a playing standpoint. Brooks gets to talk about it from an owner standpoint, and he's been a player and a caddy. So he's played at a high level, and then you get the superintendent's perspective, and then you get the amateur golfer perspective as well. Like, I just think that's...
It'd be so interesting, too.
It'd be a wonderful conversation.
A lot of people who have played out here recently, too, are not necessarily griping, but being like, you know, greens are sandy, you know, tee boxes are sandy. You know,
it's not warm enough for the grass to grow.
It's not warm enough.
If they don't
put
any sand on there, they're not going
to
be smooth.
And so that's why I'm really encouraging people to like really come out here when the course is in like championship conditions, you know, in honestly less than a month, if we're being completely honest, I'd say. Probably a month or two.
Yeah.
Because like this course, when it's at its peak, is absolutely beautiful. And it was last season.
Yeah.
And this season, it's, you know, according to Adam, you know, it's supposed to be the best that it's ever been.
And it's going
to
be. And, like, when people see – so I'm going to take a shot at defending golf course architects everywhere. Like, the practices that they do, they hate doing them more than you do.
Yeah, like sandy greens.
It costs a lot of money.
Yep.
It takes a lot of man hours.
Yep.
And they get all they get is complaints because for the tiny little bit of time that they're perfect, and they're never perfect, by the way. Like, somebody will like them fast, and the next person will hate that they're too fast. Like, you literally can't satisfy anybody.
No.
And the same thing with tee times in the shop. Well, I can't find a tee time. Well, actually, you can. You just got to be a little more diligent about when you try and book. Like, you can't just show up on a Friday at 3 p.m. and go,
you can't call
you
the shop.
Hey, I'm just a single. You got a spot? No. Like, it's Friday in Franklin, Tennessee, at the only public golf course in the county. Like, no, there's not a spot open. And it's 80 degrees and sunny. Like, no. And you're not going to find a spot on the driving range either.
No.
That reality is they can never please even enough people.
I feel like if a lot of people have a little bit more appreciation for turf management. Go work their job for the week. Or just, like, if you get a chance to just Google some of the stuff that goes on. Like, I've gotten a lot of the people that I've played with, especially people who aren't necessarily from here, I've been like, why are the greens so sandy? You know, I can't hit off this tee box, whatever. It's like,
they've top dressed them 3 times in the last month, I believe.
It's
but
crazy.
That's all a part of the practices to get the course to where you want it in prime season.
Right. And it's like, if you...
late May, June, July, August.
And too, like, if you are... We also get a bunch of tourists here, or a bunch of people who are, you know, just moved here and don't necessarily understand, like, the weather of Tennessee, right? It's like, where
this isn't Southern California.
Right. And in this time of year, it could be, you know, 80 one day and 40 the next day. So it's like what you say, it's impossible to grow grass right now because it stops and then it stops and then it starts and then it stops and then you got to cut it. And then there's so much work that has to go into it.
In order for Bermuda grass to grow, in particular at the heights that it's cut for tee boxes, fairways, fringes, and greens, you need a total of 125 to 130. Now, that's the daytime high plus the nighttime low.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
So, like, people are like, oh, it's 75. It's going to start growing. I was like, not if it's 40 at night. That's 115.
Yeah, people don't understand the weather when they're sleeping.
But that's close to 125. It's like, it's not going to grow until it hits 125.
That's like a scientifically proven fact.
Yes. Like, Bermuda grass can't grow. And so, like, if it stays in those temperatures for, like, 4 or 5 days, the grass starts to grow. Mm. Well, you have to cut it.
Yeah.
But then it goes cold for a week and a half.
So you leave it.
And so... if you don't top dress it, then it's going to get bumpy because you have some of it that, like, all of it hasn't grown. Because, again, remember, not every tree blooms at the exact same time. Generally speaking, all the grass blades will start growing around the same time. And Adam, I'm sure, can give you a way more scientific answer to this than I can.
We got to have him on.
I'm giving you the general, like, layman's terms of this. But, like, if some of it grows and then it stops growing, you have grass that's now dormant. This isn't bent grass. Now, this putting surface is fantastic.
It's incredible.
And the top dressing lets it stay smooth. I can tell you that from a playing standpoint, not from I understand turf grass management standpoint, because I'm probably speaking out of my butt a little bit to try and describe to you what happens. But I can tell you, if there wasn't top dress on it right now, they would not be in as good a shape because we're in and out of this dormant season. And so... if you see them doing work like sanding greens, if you see them having cut out certain parts and replacing it, like, they are doing the work that's required to take care of grass that is far more fragile, you wouldn't want to pay what it costs to have your grass cut that short at your house.
No. Can you imagine having grass like a tenth of an inch?
Yes.
All the time? You know how much? I mean, you'd basically have to babysit that grass 24/7, 365.
Correct.
That's crazy.
Yes, and you couldn't afford it.
No, which also brings up, like, a topic, too, about, you know, the flood that we had recently, too, and how good.
Yeah, I didn't even mention that. Like, we've had flood, and all that soil and soot from the river gets deposited on the greens.
Well, yeah, that, but people think that that's a bad thing, when in reality, it's actually a great thing for the course.
It can be, absolutely, because you get all these nutrients from the soil, but when you get a lot of it, it can make things a little more challenging on maintenance, and they've done a wonderful job.
Oh, my God.
We had 3 floods in the course of, like, a month.
Crazy.
One was major. The other two were minor, but, like, one was major, you know, probably a 25-year flood. But those guys do a fantastic job. When you see them doing work, it's like, the greens are bad. I was like, actually, the greens are really good.
Yeah.
Would you like me to take you to another course that's not maintaining them in that same condition, in these current conditions where we're at, same climate? Like, no, you don't. And they're spending a lot of money to make this place super nice. Plus, They inherited a problem.
A lot of people.
Brooks has done a wonderful job, and so has Adam.
A lot of people come up to me and they'll say, like, I've gotten this question multiple times because, you know, on the tee box, you kind of, you know, exchange formalities, you know, hey, how you doing? What do you do? Are you from here?
Yep.
You know, yada, yada. And so after a while, I've gotten this question a few times is people will ask me, they'll go, you know, like, when are the greens not going to be so sandy? And my question is always, you know, after we get a couple good rains in, you know, because, like, hopefully the weather will stay hot enough.
Yep.
To where the grass will start growing, and they don't have to top layer it anymore.
But they're still going to top dress them. It's a common maintenance practice
totally.
To keep them in great shape.
Totally.
And done appropriately, which they've done the...
They have.
They have top dressed this thing beautifully
for
so
the
that
weather
it's
that
even surface, no matter which hole you're playing.
Like, yep.
They have done it at an expert level. It's people associate sandy greens with bad greens. It's like, that's not bad.
Yeah,
it's not bad.
You don't like playing on it.
The other thing is... people want to blame that for the reason why they putt bad. I was like, if we look at the number of putts that you had today
yeah.
versus number of putts you had 3 weeks ago, you're going to have the exact same number of putts.
Well, and like, listen,
in fact,
too,
you're
like,
probably better with the sand on the greens.
Do you think so? Because that's what I was going to ask you is that I was going to be like, if you get Dustin Johnson out here and you get him to play on our course in a championship condition and our course, let's say right now, you know, I bet he makes one or two more putts on real grass.
You're going to see the overall scoring average be virtually the same.
But, like,
it's going to be unchanged.
Like, after 100 rounds, you know, it's probably going to be
right.
close to the same.
Yeah, it's not, like, this is a mindset thing. People want to blame something other than themselves because they can't handle the pain of the fact that they can't do it. It's a lot easier to go, it's your fault. I just hate playing with that guy. Well, if you're thinking about that guy, then that's on you. I don't like playing with so-and-so. Like, I didn't like playing with that guy that upset me. Like, it was kind of a jerk and just was, like, completely way too cocky and completely oblivious. Like, I don't like playing with that. But, like, if I play bad and I let that affect me, that's on me, not on him.
Yeah, love that.
Greens are... Oh, these greens are too slow. I just can't putt on slow greens. Well, then you probably can't putt on slow greens because you've determined that you can't. So, like, don't give me the greens are bad baloney. They're not bad. These
guys
are doing a wonderful job.
Makes sense.
And it's not just for these guys here. There are guys all over the country that, I mean, the fact that we didn't do a massive hole punch last year and the greens were puttable in literally that afternoon.
Yeah, I'd rather play on sandy greens.
It's never happened
at
a golf course.
Greens.
People quickly forget that, too.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just like, I understand people don't want to putt on sandy greens, but stop blaming the sandy greens for something that's not the reason why you can't make putts.
That's fair. Well, I think that's going to do it for our second episode. We're going to start calling it Podcasting at the Pub. We've previously called it Ask Sherlock, which, you know, Scott is famous for his name Sherlock, but we're going to start calling it for
I
this
didn't come
season.
Up with that name, by the way.
That's right. He did not come up with that name, but we're going to start calling it Podcasting at the Pub and, you know, featuring Scott Hasse. So this is actually going to be our season 2, episode 2 of the Podcasting at the Pub series, which we're going to do every single Wednesday night at 7 p.m. So there's always going to be a food special. There's always going to be a drink special. Make sure to come out. I know we've had some crappy weather the past two Wednesdays. We've had a few rains, but as things start to warm up, we get some cornhole going out here. We get some drinks going. We got a little great showing today for Mr. Cam, who hit this hole in one on 14. So that's great. So we hope to see you guys out at the pub at 7 p.m. on Wednesdays. And remember, you can listen to this podcast everywhere that you listen to podcasts, either on Apple Music, Spotify, Google Podcasts, anywhere that you can get podcasts, we're there. So just go ahead and search the Champions Playbook, give us a review, and hopefully we're going to have some good podcasts to come, including, but not limited to, our owner Brooks West. We'll potentially get Adam on, our superintendent.
Yep.
We'll put Logan on.
Logan likes to talk more.
Logan does like to talk a little more. For the ladies out there, we do have a lot of topics about women's golf. We've got a lot of topics about women's golf, and Scott and I are very opinionated on it in the best of ways. So make sure to come out 7 p.m. Wednesdays here at the pub.
I'm going to throw out a surprise I've been thinking about this week.
Ooh, go for it.
It's going to be a 4th of July surprise, and I haven't exactly figured out how to title it yet, but... It's going to basically be freedom on the 4th from your old swing. and I'm going to walk the range all day. We're going to try and live do all of this.
Oh, like
around
people?
That time period. May not be on the 4th of July, but we'll do this stuff live, and the challenge is going to be, how fast can I fix it?
I love it. And for those of you, too, like...
Can I do it inside of 2 swings, 3 swings, 1 swing, 5 swings,
bam.
5 minutes, 10 minutes? Like, how many swings can I fix? Like, actually change the ball flight and change performance substantially. Have a track man out there. Like, we'll have the whole
deal. We might
deal.
Post that on YouTube as well, so stay tuned.
How fast and, can you fix it, baby?
And also, too, remember that, like, Scott gave away a free 30-minute lesson today. So if you show up, ask
you
a great question...
Get.
Scott gave out a free lesson today, so if you guys want to try your hand at asking an awesome question that maybe Scott can't answer in 2 or 3 minutes, maybe he'll give you a free
it's
lesson.
It's like
on
me
it.
Handing you $125 cash.
Bam.
Except you get to use it for a golf lesson.
There you go. There you go. Well, from that, it is Scott and Jack from the back porch of the Persimmon Pub. Remember, drink specials, food specials every night at 7 p.m., and we'll see you next week. Peace.
Thanks, y'all, for listening to this episode of the Champions Playbook. As always, you can find us anywhere that you guys are. So make sure to check out Scott on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all of the above. His Instagram is at shasseygolf. That's 2 S's and 2 E's. So make sure to go and check out everything that he's got going on over on his Instagram page. As well as make sure you follow Franklin Bridge. Franklin Bridge puts out some great things as well, and we want to make sure that we support them because they support us. So as always, feel free to come by the back porch of the Persimmon Pub at 7 p.m. on Wednesdays to come and listen to us talk golf. So book a late afternoon round of golf, and then afterwards, come on inside, get some food, some drinks. We got some specials going on. We have some $5 flatbread pizzas. We had some amazing chicken tacos, as well as drink specials going on all night long. So make sure to support the Persimmon Pub as well when you come out. We would love to see you guys. We do one episode and then a live Q&A and then another episode. So from 7 to 9 on Wednesdays, we hope to see you soon, and we'll see you on the next one. Peace.